This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today, the Prime Ministers of Australia and New Zealand meet and they're going to discuss how to coordinate their efforts as both countries try to reassert their influence in the Pacific. Also, Fiji's opposition expresses doubts over whether the government there will adopt key recommendations from international election observers. And
tell her we're all out fishing and hope we can find the money that we're required to get those countries to attend the game.
There's a race against time to find more money, otherwise dozens of Vanuatu athletes and possibly others from other countries as well are at risk of not being able to compete at this year's Pacific Games in Samoa. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company this morning. First, though, there are concerns the presence of guns on Bougainville may have an impact on the upcoming scheduled referendum on whether the region becomes independent from PNG. A weapons disposal program destroyed most of the firearms that had been used in the civil war that ravaged the island back in the 1990s. But some experts say there could still be several hundred guns in the hands of former combatants and criminals. A local MP fears the weapons in his constituency could deter some people from taking part in the vote, as Liam Fox reports.
Along with the referendum itself, weapons disposal is one of the three main pillars of the 2001 peace agreement that ended the decade-long civil war known as the Bougainville Crisis. In the years immediately after the agreement was signed, a United Nations-supervised process resulted in the collection and destruction of just over 2,000 guns. But since then, little has been done to collect the remaining weapons still in the hands of former combatants, criminals and other groups.
I'll be, you know, forthright with what I have to say. And I think there are still many weapons out there in South Bougainville and other parts of Bougainville.
Timothy Massieu is the member for South Bougainville in the PNG Parliament. Parts of his constituency have been identified as hotspots for gun-related violence and crime. A problem he's experienced firsthand.
When my vehicle, my official vehicle in the electorate was held up by an armed man and taken away from us.
He believes the presence of guns could impact the upcoming referendum by deterring some people from taking part in the vote.
The risk of the presence of this gun is so high because, you know, people would be just too scared. There are already people expressing their desire that they don't want to be part of this referendum thing. They don't want to vote. And there are people saying that they want to leave Bougainville when this referendum takes place. Just the presence of a gun, you know, it scares the daylight out of people.
A recent report by PNG's National Research Institute identified two key weapons-related risks to the conduct of a successful referendum. One is that the presence of weapons and spoiler groups could obstruct the voting and undermine the credibility of the referendum. The other is that localised conflict, in which weapons have been used in the past, could re-emerge as the referendum approaches. Anthony Regan is a constitutional lawyer, academic and advisor to the Bougainville government, who's done extensive research on weapons disposal. He says it's hard to say exactly how many guns are still on the island.
No one really knows. Probably at maximum 200 or 300, but it could be more, it could be less.
But Mr. Regan believes a recent renewed push to convince people to give up their guns will see most of them collected ahead of the vote. And he points to the recent decision by the head of the Mekamui Defence Force, one of the remnants of the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, to join a weapons disposal secretariat as a reason to be optimistic.
There's a very strong popular support for the referendum, and it would be most unlikely anybody's going to do anything to upset it.
Back in Bougainville South, Mr. Massieu is also confident the referendum will proceed, despite the risks posed by the guns in his constituency.
I think, and I'm positive that the referendum will still go ahead, and I'm positive also that people will vote.
That is Timothy Massieu. He's the MP for South Bougainville, and Liam Fox was our reporter there. Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison will meet his New Zealand counterpart Jacinda Ardern in Auckland today. The two countries' approach to the Pacific is likely to make up a large part of their discussions. The so-called Pacific Step Up or the Pacific Reset is one area that the two countries largely see eye to eye. But there are still some points of tension in the relationship between the neighbouring countries. So will they be raised by the Prime Ministers? Our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts is in New Zealand, and I spoke with him a short time ago. Stephen, you're there in New Zealand. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, will be meeting with the New Zealand PM, Jacinda Ardern. What's on the agenda?
Look, I think the Pacific will loom pretty large in the discussions today, Catherine. Both Australia and New Zealand, of course, have said that they're going to intensify their diplomatic engagement in the Pacific. The two countries call it different things. Australia calls it a step up. New Zealand calls it their Pacific reset. But the intent here is basically the same. Both Australia and New Zealand really want to reassert their influence in the region, particularly as other players flex their muscles. And both countries have announced an expansion of diplomatic networks, more money for aid and infrastructure in the region, a higher tempo when it comes to defence cooperation and training, etc. So there are some similarities between the two agendas. And broadly speaking, only broadly, Australia and New Zealand do have pretty similar visions for the Pacific. So you can expect the two prime ministers to discuss how they'll coordinate their efforts to ensure that both those initiatives are successful. And on top of that, Catherine, I think there'll be plenty of pretty routine discussions on issues that could firmly be called boring but important, including biosecurity, cooperation, dealing with emerging technologies like 5G, and economic integration between the two countries.
Well, Stephen, as you mentioned there, particularly in regards to matters relating to the Pacific, that Australia and New Zealand are relatively on the same page. But there are areas that aren't. Do you think there'll be any difficult discussions had as well?
Yes, I think there will be. Sore points do remain in the bilateral relationship. Of course, Jacinda Ardern's repeatedly said that New Zealand's willing to resettle some refugees on Manus Island and Nauru in New Zealand. Australia's repeatedly turned down that offer, at least for now, worrying that it will encourage people smugglers. And interestingly, this morning, there's a report in the Courier Mail newspaper in Australia suggesting that when Malcolm Turnbull was Prime Minister, senior New Zealand officials privately told their Australian counterparts that New Zealand wouldn't be open to resettling single male asylum seekers on Manus Island, despite Jacinda Ardern's public statements. I guess the implication from that is that they would only be willing to take families and children and women from Nauru. So again, that puts that particular disagreement firmly back in the spotlight. Still, the main irritant, you'd have to say, in the relationship remains Australia's hardline policy of deporting criminals back to New Zealand. Now, this policy really angers New Zealand, because many of the New Zealand citizens who are sent back here have actually spent most or perhaps all of their lives in Australia. So the people have almost no connection to this country. Some don't even realise that they're even Australian, that they aren't Australian citizens at all. And many of them then commit crimes when they come back to New Zealand, which angers Wellington. They believe that we are foisting social problems of our making onto them. So expect Jacinda Ardern to make that point again to Scott Morrison today, but don't expect Australia to budge. The Coalition has made it very clear that that policy is here to stay.
That is our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts, who's in New Zealand today. Well, the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, has told his bishops at the highly anticipated summit on child sexual abuse that the world expects them to put in place concrete and effective measures. Bishops from around the world, including the head of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands, are at the Vatican for the historic summit. Survivors of clerical abuse are demanding the church commits to a policy of zero tolerance for abusive priests and bishops who cover up for them. The ABC's Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan has this report from Rome.
Thousands of the faithful stream into St Peter's Square each morning, today pausing at its breathtaking beauty on a bright blue day in Rome. But these are dark days for the Catholic Church. The Vatican is suffering a crisis of credibility over the abuse of children and the cover-up of the crimes. At this summit for cardinals, bishops and the leaders of religious orders, Pope Francis told the Catholic hierarchy it's time they agreed on concrete measures to confront the evil of abuse. The Pope has proposed 21 discussion points, including appointing more experts to deal with allegations of abuse, punishment for pedophiles and further screening measures for seminarians. Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Coleridge.
The key word, if I could use the Italian that the Pope used today, concretezza, concreteness. What we need is real concrete action, and this meeting, I am certain, will provide real impetus in that direction.
But Pope Francis's commitment to listen to the voices of those wounded by the Church seems hollow to survivors like Pete Saunders.
Well, the Pope has proved that he's not really interested in bringing real change.
The Pope called those who accused the Church friends and cousins of the devil this week, and that's angered victims.
But the comments that he made, the accusations that people who accuse the Church, and by that I assume he means us, the survivors of abuse who are doing our very best to protect our children and our children's children, to attack us and to say that we are friends, relatives and cousins of the devil. I mean, okay, I put it down to a kind of Trumpian tantrum, but in some parts of the world, his words will be followed very closely, and it may endanger the lives of survivors who speak out.
There are many victims from across the world who've come to Rome vying for time with the Pope. Many won't get that audience. Instead, they'll be on the sidelines urging serious reform of the organisation which broke their trust and faith.
That is Bridget Brennan reporting there, and we hope to be able to bring you on Monday an interview with the head of the Catholic Bishops Conference of PNG and Solomon Islands, who's there, and get all of the outcomes of that summit. That'll be on Pacific Beach on Monday morning.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Fiji's opposition parties say that it's critical that the government there implement recommendations contained in a report from international observers on last year's national election that concluded the poll, which was just the second since Fiji's last coup in 2006, significantly advanced electoral democracy in the country. The multinational observer group publicly released its report this week, finding that the electoral processes had been transparent and credible, but they did have 21 recommendations, which included them reviewing the electoral offences to ensure that penalties for offences are proportionate to the crimes, also recommending that they require political parties to report their campaign expenditures after the election, and possibly also putting a cap on campaign spending. They've also suggested that Fiji should develop guidelines that help outline the expected conduct of ministers when a government's in caretaker mode ahead of the or an election. Here is Jane Prentice, who's the Australian MP and was one of three co-chairs leading the group of international observers. She spoke with Pacific Beat on that particular recommendation yesterday.
The members of the observation group felt that if there were clearer guidelines around the caretaker period, what was allowed and what was inappropriate, and that was set out more clearly. We don't believe anyone wants to break the law, but if the law or the regulations aren't clear, then it can lead to accusations of some people having more advantage than others.
Well, that recommendation in particular has been welcomed by the leader of the National Federation Party, Biman Prasad, who is part of the opposition. I spoke with him earlier.
I think that's a correct observation by the MOG, and we were obviously seriously concerned at the lack of any convention or perceived convention about, you know, what government should do when the election dates are announced. Essentially, there is no provision for a caretaker government in the current constitution, and the government took that opportunity to actually go against all the normal conventions in a democratic framework and continued to hand out, you know, grants and continued to open, you know, government taxpayer-funded projects, all in an attempt to influence the voters. So I think that recommendation by the MOG about developing a code of conduct for the government and members of parliament during the election period is a good one.
Just on this aspect and the lack of the caretaker protocols, etc., that exist there within Fiji. Now, as was raised during the election campaign, there were concerns that perhaps government ministers were breaching this. And yet, as the MOG report says, FICAC, Fiji's anti-corruption body, says that there were no breaches that they received. Why is that? I mean, why didn't you, if you had concerns, why didn't you in opposition take some of those cases to FICAC?
The had indicated that we will put some of those evidence and cases to FICAC, and our lawyers are still working on it, and we will be considering that very soon.
That's the leader of the National Federation Party, Biman Prasad, there. He has raised his concerns, though, with Pacific Beat over whether that particular recommendation or any of the other 20 recommendations from the Multinational Observer Group will be considered, let alone adopted, by the Fiji government.
We also believe that the last report, which was put out by the MOG group in 2014, has basically been ignored by the current government. And we don't think that this government is going to take any note of the recommendations that this MOG has made with respect to the 2018 election.
Pacific Beat has made multiple attempts to contact both the Fiji Elections Supervisor and Elections Minister for interviews without success. However, the Minister, Aya Syed Kayum, has released a statement late last night saying that the group has made a number of worthwhile recommendations and that the report will be tabled before Parliament. Fiji's health minister says that childhood obesity is a disaster in slow motion, and he's calling for a concerted regional effort to combat the disease. His remarks came during this week's Pacific Ending Childhood Obesity Forum in Fiji. As Priyanka Srinivasan reports, one of the strategies under consideration is to limit the aggressive junk food marketing that some people believe is negatively targeting Pacific youth.
The Pacific's weight problem is nothing new, with many island countries rated among the fattest in the world year after year. But a new network on childhood obesity is hoping to create a uniquely Pacific response to the crisis. The Pacific Ending Childhood Obesity Network Forum, or Pacific Echo Network, brought together more than 40 healthcare professionals from across the region. They aim to develop a tailored solution to the obesity epidemic facing Pacific children. The meeting was facilitated by the South Pacific community, whose Director General, Colin Tukui Tonga, believes the influence of foreign food marketing is partly to blame for children's ballooning waistlines.
There's so much influence that come in from the outside on what children get fed, on images that they see, images about food and drink, advertising, and there's a general view that these should be limited, that what gets advertised at the moment, most people would say, does not constitute what experts would say is a healthy diet.
He believes that there is a great need to develop a coordinated regional solution to childhood obesity.
You can't have Tonga plug away themselves at trying to limit those images, because the images come in off the internet, made in Australia, New Zealand, US and Canada. This is why collaboration is so important, because a small island in the middle of the Pacific trying to limit these things is not likely to have any impact at all.
An increasing number of Pacific governments are looking to regulations to combat non-communicable diseases. Most significantly, at least 12 Pacific countries have adopted sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, with others looking to do the same soon. Mr. Tukui Tonga says this approach builds on insights gained by attempts to regulate the tobacco industry.
To counteract the effect of the tobacco industry, small island states will have no impact on the industry, and that's where the power of collective action comes into play. The point is that you need to act together, because if you allow yourselves to be picked off one by one for the tobacco industry, we're not going anywhere in a hurry.
Diana Burasova from the McCabe Centre for Law and Cancer in Fiji was one of the participants at the ECHO meeting this week. Her organisation works with government lawyers across the Pacific to design effective health regulation. She agrees that interference from industrial lobby groups is a constant problem when trying to tackle big health issues like childhood obesity.
Industry interference is significant when it comes to government formulating policies or regulatory measures around these NTD risk factors. So there's been considerable pushback from the industry here in the Pacific region. There's anecdotal evidence and from interactions that we've had with government ministry officials who have encountered all manner of interference.
Last year, in a submission to New Zealand's tax working group, Coca-Cola stated that a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages was, quote, unnecessary and should not be introduced. The company also stated it was already making efforts to reduce the sugar content in its drinks. Nevertheless, Ms. Burasova believes that by sharing experiences and research between Pacific countries, governments can better design more robust regulations based on sound science.
I think there's a lot to be gained from sharing experiences. And, you know, even though the context may vary from each country, there are actually common themes.
That's Diana Burasova from the McCabe Centre for Law and Cancer. Priyanka Srinivasan reporting there. Finally, this morning, the Vanuatu Rugby League is racing against the clock to find some way of getting its squad to this year's Pacific Games in Samoa. The National Olympic Committee, VASANOC, has told the NRL that there's no room for them on the chartered plane that will take Team Vanuatu to Apia in July. Indoor volleyball has also been cut from Vanuatu's travelling party of athletes. And as Richard Hewitt reports, the president of VASANOC says the matter's now in the hands of the national government.
The exclusion of rugby league from Team Vanuatu's Pacific Games contingent has come as a bitter blow, with officials opting not to speak publicly about it other than to release a statement saying they will explore every possible opportunity to compete in Samoa. The Rugby League International Federation has been made aware of Vanuatu's plight, and International Development Officer Taz Batiri says if they can help, they will, particularly as it would be in the broader interests of the game to have Vanuatu in Apia.
It's part of a broader picture for the game itself. The RLIF are really supportive of the games and that rugby league is a sport within the games. It's the only multi-sport event around the world that we are considered to play in. They have the Mediterranean games, they have the Asian games, and rugby league's not part of that. The Pacific Games, we're allowed to play in it every 4 years, and it's unfortunate that Vanuatu suffered in 15 and now we're going to suffer in 19.
The Vanuatu Rugby League have made no criticism of VASANOC over their decision-making, although, as Taz Batiri points out, this will be the second games in a row from which they've been excluded. VASANOC's president, Antoine Boulier, says it would require some $400,000 Australian dollars to charter a second plane and fund the expenses of the athletes who travel on it. So far, the government has agreed to allocate $600,000 to Vanuatu's games costs, and now the case will be put to them for more.
We have prepared for him the list of the sports that will be missing, the reason why they're missing, what would be the budget if we had to take those sports as well in Team Vanuatu, and then the Council of Ministers can take the final decision.
If the government can't come up with extra cash, then the onus would seem to be very much on the RLIF. But with the deadline for entries at the Pacific Games just days away, Taz Batiri says they'll have to find a bag full of money from somewhere.
There's no answer right now, and I don't want to predict one either because it could be the wrong one anyway. So we're all out fishing and hope we can find the money that we're required to get those countries to attend the games.
Looking long-term, Antoine Boudier is hoping an official government sports policy, which is being worked on right now, could future-proof what is likely to be a recurring problem, with, for example, Vanuatu's men's hockey team needing to find $120,000 if they're to play in an Olympic qualification tournament in Malaysia later this year.
On the actual policy document that we are working on, we're currently trying to secure some funding that will be recurrent into the budget of the Vanuatu government, and we're trying to secure $1 million, if not more, for Team Vanuatu for special occasions, such as if it is a team that needs to travel. We might be called by the federations desperately needing financial assistance, and then the funding could come from that pot.
In terms of the immediate problem for the rugby league team, Australia is in generous mood towards the sport at the moment, having invested in the Fiji bid to join the New South Wales Cup competition. And now a Senate Estimates Committee has been hearing about rugby league diplomacy and plans to expand PNG's involvement in the Australian rugby league scene.
why don't we help them financially to get into the National Rugby League competition?
That's not out of the scope of the program that the Prime Minister announced late last year. We are quite ambitious with this program, and we would like to see more Papua New Guinean teams playing in significant competitions in Australia. So we will work in very close partnership with NRL and with the government of Papua New Guinea and other governments as we step this forward.
First Assistant Secretary Kathy Klugman from the Australian Government's Pacific Strategy Division there replying to a question from Government Senator Ian MacDonald. And based on that evidence, now may not be a bad time for the Vanuatu Rugby League team and the International Federation to make a polite inquiry in Canberra.
That's Richard Hewitt reporting, and we will continue to keep an eye on developments there and bring them to you here on Pacific Beat. Well, that is all for the program this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company this week. I'll be back same time Monday morning.